This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Among the numerous concerns raised against the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, allowing genetically modified organisms into our food supply, and the ability for multinational corporations and foreign investors to sue our government are the two issues that the Third World Network is focusing on. Today with me is Lim Lee Ching of Third World Network, and we're asking her to explain why she's not convinced by the TPP's supposed overall benefits. Welcome to the show, Lee Ching.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me on the show.
Let's start off with ISDS. How does ISDS work, and why is the Third World Network against it?
Well, I think there are many concerns that are raised on investor-state dispute settlement. We have to see it in the context of the investment chapter, of course, for which grants foreign investors a very broad swathe of rights. What is qualified as an investment is very broad, for example, including intellectual property, futures, expected profits, derivatives, etc. So I think that's one concern, that because the investment chapter itself grants foreign investors these great rights, and then coupled with the dispute settlement mechanism of ISDS, which allows the corporation to directly sue a government for any measures that it perceives or feels that affects its investment in the country, I think grants a very, in a way, a blank check to these foreign investors. So many concerns have been raised, and as Third World Network, we've been working globally as well on this issue. So it's not just within Malaysia, but this is, probably one of the most controversial issues in the TPP discussions that are happening right now, not just in Malaysia, but in the other countries. And many countries are now relooking, for example, at some of their bilateral investment agreements or treaties which have similar provisions, because they are realizing that the exposure that governments have because of ISDS is too great of a burden to bear. And many of the suits that have been brought, we've seen an increasing number of lawsuits against governments, more than 600 over known cases. Many of these are also conducted in secret, so we don't actually have that much information about them. But from what we know, on cases judged on merit, about 60% have been awarded in favour of, concluded in favour of the investor. And the awards that are granted run into billions, millions of dollars, even billions in some of the more extreme cases. And at the end of the day, the government, as holding the public purse, we are subjecting ourselves to this huge liability.
Is there an alternative to how foreign investors' rights could be protected? Because, of course, the counter-argument to that is that you're making it more attractive for foreign investors to want to come into our country. You're making it, they feel more secure, they feel more protected. Is that something that we can still provide for without, having to deal with all the other repercussions?
I certainly think so. I mean, if we think about providing investors into our own country, the protection, we have our domestic courts, for example, which do provide a certain level of surety and of guarantee for investors. And we've also heard the argument raised by the Ministry of International Trade and Industry, for example, that we shouldn't just think of ourselves, but we should also think about our investors overseas. But there are many other ways for investors to seek this kind of similar protection apart from ISDS. For example, investors can take out investor contracts directly, or take up political risk insurance if it's a particularly risky country that you think you're investing in and you're not so confident in their judiciary or the judicial system. So there are other means by which investors can be protected. I think, when one talks about a balance between investors' rights and, public policy, we need to also think about when governments are, directly sued by corporations, the liability is on the public purse, whereas we protect them, our own corporations overseas, they're private companies. We're protecting, a private entity. So I don't think there's quite a balance there.
What are the lessons that we can take away from the cases of corporations suing governments in the past? For instance, Philip Morris in Australia.
Mm-hmm. I think, one of the major concerns that we have, apart from the actual suits that have been brought, etc., and the exposure of government to these liabilities, is really the what we call the regulatory chill or the chill factor. Because many governments quite often in past cases have actually reversed what they may have been wanting to take an environmental protection measure, for example, or public health measure and were dissuaded from doing so because of the threat, the mere threat of a lawsuit, not even the actual filing of the case. And we see that, for example, you mentioned the Philip Morris case for which they sued Australia for its plain packaging laws. New Zealand and even Malaysia, when asked about this issue as to whether we would also put in place plain packaging laws, because, of course, the evidence shows, and the WHO as well has said, that these plain packaging laws are very good in dissuading new people from picking up cigarette smoking, which of course is detrimental to public health and places a tremendous burden on the healthcare system of a country. And these countries said, well, let's wait and see what happens first in the Philip Morris case, because we don't want to, the threat of a lawsuit could dissuade governments from actually putting in place a proactive public health or environmental measures.
On the show yesterday, we had Malaysia's chief negotiator, Datuk Jay Jayasiri, and this is what he had to say on the ISDS.
In the TPP, we have a chapter called the General Exceptions, and in the General Exceptions chapter, there is a provision where it says very clearly that governments have the right to regulate, and these are in the public interest. In examples are in like environment, health, moral reasons. On top of that, even in the investment chapter, this is reiterated again, and it says very clearly that governments will have the right to regulate.
So in other words, our government's public policy interests would be protected against corporate profiteering. Would you say this is sufficient?
Well, I mean, of course, when you take it at face value and you say yes, of course, he's very right in the general exceptions chapter. There is an exception for environmental and health measures. This is based on the WTO GATT agreement, Article 20. What's in the TPP, if you look at it carefully and in detail, is actually narrower in scope than what's under the WTO GATT agreement in the first place. In the second place, what we need to look at is also the WTO jurisprudence and the case law. What this has shown that in all but one case, when countries tried to use the GATT Article 20 exceptions in order to defend their public policy measures, whether it be for health or the environment, they were unable to do so. So in practice, although we have this in the general exceptions chapter, it's probably insufficient. And secondly, he mentioned Article 9.15 in the investment chapter, which says, of course, it says very clearly that, parties to the TPP can take measures to protect the environment and public health. However, it's qualified because it also says that these measures must be consistent with the investment chapter. So, in effect, it actually negates the exception. And it doesn't mean that we have enough safeguards in place. And we don't believe this is a sufficient safeguard because it's actually a meaningless provision.
So is the ISDS good in theory but poor in implementation? Or because, of course, we have a lot of you have a lot of things that sound good on paper, and then in practice it doesn't always pan out. Is this one of those cases, or is it that even on paper you think we require perhaps more detail?
Well, I think it's not just a matter of poor implementation. I think we need to fundamentally relook at how we are crafting this balance between protecting investors' rights and trespassing on the right to a clean environment or the right to health, for example. The balance, as in the TPPA investment chapter, is strongly tilted towards protecting the rights of foreign corporations. Now, when, of course, you link the investor-state dispute mechanism with many of the other chapters in the TPPA as well, this opens a whole load of other issues which could be subject to investor-state dispute settlement. So, yes, there are some procedural improvements that have been now included, because there is a recognition, I think, globally as well, because this issue has been under discussion for quite some time, that an acknowledgement that, in a way, that the system is broken and that something needs to change. But I don't think making procedural or process-type amendments, while they might help, like, for example, you know, BT says, well, you know, there's a clear provision in there that you can't bring frivolous cases. But this is the case anyway, in any court of law, you know, a judge would throw out a frivolous case. So I think, you know, some of the so-called safeguards that have been put in place are, you know, in a way, window dressing. They're not quite, they don't go deep to the heart of the substance of the investment chapter, which is really all about protecting investor rights.
Would this, you know, some critics have claimed that we would lose our sovereignty through this. How would that happen?
Well, I mean, one thing that, of course, the whole ISDS mechanism does is it allows the foreign corporation to actually bypass our national judiciary, our domestic courts, which, of course, you know, in any company that is aggrieved could bring a suit through the domestic process, but it doesn't do that if it has the choice of ISDS. They may well go straight directly to the tribunal to do so. I think the issue of sovereignty, you know, it also goes beyond ISDS, because when we look at, for example, there's a so-called certification process which the USA requires in its domestic law, by which the president must actually certify or actually in writing tell Congress that he is satisfied that the TPP partner countries' implementation of the laws you know, to implement the TPP is to their satisfaction. And we've seen examples in other US FTAs where the US has used this process to actually, let me put it frankly, US officials end up drafting another country's law. Or, you know, so the reach is very deep into our own domestic processes. I mean, this is a sovereign country. We should have the ability to be able to determine our own laws and to be able to do it in the best interests of our people. And if you have either interference from another country or from corporations which have a great vested interest, then I think this is an affront to our sovereignty.
Can governments bring an ISDS dispute to the tribunal?
No. Yeah, you see, it's rather one-sided because it's investor-state dispute settlement. Governments, the TPP, like many other previous free trade agreements or even the processes under the WTO, has a state-to-state dispute settlement procedure. That's where if a company, for example, in the USA is not happy with something in Malaysia, for example, it would then go through its government and put pressure on its government and say, hey, look, I've been aggrieved here. Can you, you know, take this other country to the dispute settlement mechanism? But the ISDS allows then now corporations to directly sue governments, but there's no reciprocity. The governments can't sue the corporations through this ISDS mechanism.
So they would have to take it into other courts through other procedures.
Yeah.
I'm speaking today with Lim Lee Ching of Third World Network, and we're discussing ISDS in the TPP. Up next, we'll be talking instead about GMOs. They've received less attention, but that doesn't mean that they should. So we are talking about that after this short message from our sponsors. You're listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. We are talking about the TPP today, or specifically about the ISDS and GMOs. I have with me in studio Lim Lee Ching of Third World Network. So GMOs have received less attention in this debate that's been ongoing. What concerns you about GMOs within the agreement?
Okay, maybe I should explain some of the acronyms that we're using. GMOs are genetically modified organisms. These are organisms that have been modified in the lab through genetic engineering or modern biotechnology. They are subject to international regulation because there is a UN international treaty that governs GMOs. And this is called the Cartagena Protocol on Biosafety. I think we need to recognize that for genetically modified crops, the biggest producer in the world is the United States. And their agriculture, you know, is very largely genetically modified, and that's what they grow. And, of course, they export these crops all over the world as commodities, largely for the food, feed and processing industry. So we can expect, of course, and we've seen in submissions, for example, from the Biotechnology Industry Organization that puts pressure on the United States Trade Representative to try and protect its interests in promoting the trade of genetically modified organisms or crops or food products within the TPPA. And usually it's also been subject of discussions within the US and even in previous fast-track laws, for example, that said that they have to have provisions that actually promote the trade in GMOs or the trade in products of modern biotechnology.
We have, you know, you have scientists who land firmly on the side of they're very, very safe. There's nothing wrong with them. You know, they're providing a sustainable way to provide food, to provide crops, to provide all sorts of different things. What do we know really definitively about the safety of genetically modified organisms?
Okay, it's still one of the most hotly debated issues in the scientific realm. And I think for very good reasons. Because there are concerns about their impacts on the environment, because these are living organisms, of course, and if you release them into the environment, it's not like, for example, a chemical product where you can easily clean it up or recall, because once they're into the environment, and they can pass the genetic material on to progeny, I mean, to offspring or through gene flow, etc. The other, of course, and much, I think, more in a way relevant for our discussion here today is about the food safety aspects. What are the implications for health on people who eat genetically modified food products? And I think that the jury is still out there. There have been no conclusive, and I don't think anyone can draw any conclusive determinations about the safety of GMOs. I mean, for example, last year, more than 300 scientists issued a statement saying there is no scientific consensus on the safety of GMOs, because there, for one scientist that says it's perfectly safe, there are others who say, well, actually, you know, there are things we should be concerned about, or at least, well, here are some research results that raise concerns and that we should actually be looking at this much more closely rather than blindly accepting them in our food products.
At this point, how much GMOs do we currently import or allow in our food supply?
I don't know the actual figures in terms of the tonnage, but I know that Malaysia has, at this point in time, we've already approved 14 separate GM events, as they're called, because they're unique events, most of which are corn and soybean. Yeah, so we have certain events, and they're given these unique identifiers. I mean, it's, again, more acronyms, MON810, for example, but that stands for a particular corn which has the trait of being insect resistant, produced by Monsanto. So we have approved this for food and for animal feed and also for processing.
Would our Biosafety Act 2007 have to be amended when the TPP is signed? And would you say that its efficacy would be compromised?
Well, there's no direct statement in the TPP that implies this at all, that this is not necessarily the case. However, there is a provision in Chapter 2 which deals with market access in goods. Which deals, Article 2.29, which actually deals with the issue of trade in products of modern biotechnology. And this is what we have looked at closely and analysed, and we do raise quite a few concerns in regard to this. If I could maybe explain it a little bit. So this article actually puts in place some procedural requirements in terms of the TPP countries cooperating, exchanging information, with regard to their approvals of genetically modified crops in the food and feed supply. But it also puts in place a procedure on how to deal with what is called low-level presence. Again, another acronym. I'm very sorry about this, LLP for short. But what it essentially means is that when, you know, all these shipments, if you imagine that when we import for food and feed things like maize or corn or soya, they actually come in bulk grain shipments, right? Big shipments. And the situation in the exporting countries and the producing countries such as the USA is that they don't segregate. Yeah. So all, whether or not it's GMO or non-GMO, it's all brought together in one common silo and then into the common shipments. So it's very hard to keep these GM products out of the supply. What happens is that for example, let's take Malaysia, we've approved 14 events, right? Very specific ones where we've gone through a thorough risk assessment. We've made a decision through the Ministry of Natural Resources and Environment, and we say, okay, we'll allow these ones in. But there may be others which we haven't allowed in. And if under our law, our National Biosafety Act, we are not allowed, you know, no for release into the environment or for placing on the market as food and food products, this cannot be done if there's no approval. But what LLP says is that, well, if there's a small low-level presence, and they don't define it, there's no definition of what you mean by low-level presence, right?
What is low, what is high,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, is it 1%, 5%? Who knows, right? It's not defined. So they say if one country has approved this product, for example, the USA, and they grow it there, but Malaysia, you haven't approved it, but because it's approved in that one other country, then, you know, here's a procedure on how to deal with this. And basically, I think the push, and we've seen this in other discussions globally, is that the push is to allow this so-called low-level contamination of unapproved GMOs into our food supply. So this actually circumvents our own national procedures, which are really about subjecting every GMO to a thorough risk assessment, to a thorough safety evaluation, to meet our own national standards, you know, for safety, and to rely on some other country's approval process and say, okay, I agree with that. Now, I think that, again, is really, you know, in a sense, it does impact on our national sovereignty as well, because we want to be able to determine for ourselves what we judge to be, you know, right or okay to enter into our country.
What, so when we say that LLP is, or low-level presence is undefined, does that mean that it's something we can push to get defined, or does it mean that it's just going to remain what it is because it's just a phrase now and it's in common parlance, so to speak?
What this probably means is that then if you follow the procedures in the TPP, the parties will start actually, if they don't have anything, will start defining thresholds to say whether it's 1% or 0.1%, etc. But the thing is, like in our current law, because we don't allow unapproved varieties into the country, this essentially means we have a de facto or an implicit zero tolerance policy, which means that, you know, if it's not approved, it's illegal. It should be sent back or, you know, destroyed, etc. And our law provides for that. But if we put in place a policy or we put in place a procedure, as you know, recommended by the TPPA, to say that you allow some low level presence, even though it's unapproved in your country, and then countries will start defining thresholds, right? And that effectively means you've abandoned your zero tolerance policy de facto.
Malaysia is a signatory to the Cartagena Protocol on Biosafety, which has more stringent provisions than the TPP. But would provisions in the TPP supersede that protocol?
Well, I think it really depends on how it's implemented nationally. It's true that the provisions that we see on low-level presence in the TPP are actually lower than what we are legally obliged to do under the Cartagena Protocol on Biosafety, because the Cartagena Protocol is quite clear. When there are so-called unintentional transboundary movements, that means it wasn't intended, but, you know, it somehow entered into that food or feed supply. You know, there are very certain things that parties must do. For example, the exporting party must notify, must consult the importing party, and then come to a decision on how to deal. You know, whether you take emergency measures, which could mean rejecting a shipment, for example. And also there's another provision in the Cartagena Protocol that deals with illegal transboundary movements. And that just means, as if we haven't approved it, for example, in Malaysia, we have the right to reject that shipment, to dispose it even, or to put penalties or you know, fines, etc. So while Malaysia, of course, has obligations under this Cartagena Protocol, while the TPP says that you don't have to change your laws or policy to deal with this issue of low-level procedures, occurrences, what we are afraid of is that the pressure put by the large exporting countries such as the USA and Canada, and we know that the pressure can be quite intense because here we're talking about billions of dollars. For example, China, when it was rejecting shipments of a certain genetically modified corn from the US because they hadn't approved it yet, although the USA had approved it, the US lost about $1 to $3 billion in corn exports to China. So it is a big deal for them. And you can imagine that the pressure can be great. What we are worried about is that we may just, you know, abandon our implicit zero tolerance policy and say, okay, let's implement what's in the TPPA, even though it's our right to be able to decide what we want to enter into our food supply.
What positives are there for you in the TPP? Because I feel like we've been having a little bit of a look at the things that concern us, rightly so. Are there positives for you?
I think one positive that stands out, of course, for me at least, is the labour chapter, which accords much more stringent rights for workers, foreign workers as well. But of course, we can't take the TPP in isolation, because although this one chapter might be quite good, or perhaps a chapter on, say, small SMEs might be quite good, but when we take the TPP in totality, and we need to look at the interlinkages between this very complicated agreement to see what are the implications overall, there's nothing to stop Malaysia, for example, from implementing all our commitments under the ILO. Which is what the TPP asks you to do. There's nothing to stop us from implementing our own laws, our own labour laws, for the benefit of workers. Why do we need, something like the TPP to do that? Especially when you look at it in totality, and we feel very much so in our analysis that there's so many issues that are raised, whether it be the impact on access to affordable medicines, the whole issue of investor rights and ISDS, many issues that we need to look very closely at. Overall, for us, we would feel that there are much more costs than there are benefits.
Having said that, though, at this point in time, the TPP's passage seems inevitable. Where do we go from here?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was listening to the parliamentary debate for the last 2 days, and if we just go by the numbers, and if the MPs follow the party lines, it's quite you're quite right. It seems inevitable. So if Parliament does vote to sign, our first call would be don't sign this yet. It's too soon. We need to really, really scrutinise this agreement carefully because of the implications it's going to have, not just on us, but for generations to come. But then if Parliament does decide to vote to sign, we would say don't ratify. You cannot commit ourselves to ratifying because that's legally binding. There's a 2-year period for which they're supposed to look at all the laws and the amendments that have to be made. And some parliamentarians have quite wisely called for a very specific parliamentary select committee, for example, with very specific terms of reference and for which their results will be taken into account to look at this very closely. I mean, I think that's quite a good thing to do that at this stage. Ideally, of course, it should have been done way earlier. But we're at the stage where we are at now, and we would just say, why the rush? Why the rush to sign? And definitely, we shouldn't commit ourselves to ratification even at this stage. And for all you know, in the USA, they may not even consider the TPP till after the elections. So we don't know what's going to happen. So why should we, rush into this?
So basically, slow it down.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming in today. I've been speaking with Lim Lee Ching of Third World Network. We've been discussing investor dispute settlements as well as genetically modified organisms in the TPP today. And you've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.